80 people were arrested in St. Louis during last night's protests after a former police officer was acquitted over the fatal shooting of a black man. St. Louis Public Radio's Erica Hunzinger will tell us what's been happening. Plus, Illinois' public universities saw significant declines in enrollment and thousands of lost jobs as a result of the two-year budget impasse. What does this mean for the future of higher ed in Illinois?
They're going to have less money to spend. They're going to be contributing less in terms of tax dollars. And the overall impact is that you have a drag on the economy.
We'll take a critical look at the college rankings from U.S. News and World Report and ask, should we give them as much attention as we do? And we're exploring the role of Agent Orange in the Vietnam War. Turns out the chemical weapon has surprising roots in Illinois. Finally, 15% of Illinois lawmakers aren't running for re-election. We'll bring you all that and more in our regular Illinois politics conversation. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. On Friday, a former St. Louis police officer, Jason Stockley, was acquitted in the 2011 death of Anthony Lamar Smith, a black man who was fatally shot following a high-speed chase. The verdict prompted hundreds of demonstrators into the streets of downtown St. Louis and surrounding areas. The protests and demonstrations continued throughout the weekend. Police have arrested more than 100 people. More demonstrations are expected today. Joining us now on the line from St. Louis is Erica Hunzinger. She's an editor at St. Louis Public Radio who's been coordinating a team of reporters there that's been covering the events of this weekend. Erica, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Can you remind us of what this case with former St. Louis police officer Jason Stockley was all about?
Yep. In December 2011, he and his partner saw Anthony Lamar Smith. They suspected that he was dealing drugs, and so they went into a car chase. At the end of that car chase, Stockley got out of the police car, went to Smith's car and shot him 5 times. They didn't actually bring criminal charges against Stockley in the first place, and in 2013, Anthony Lamar Smith's family settled a wrongful death suit for $900,000. It wasn't until 2016, so last year, that the circuit attorney at the time decided that they would bring charges. They said that there was new evidence, although that new evidence, it wasn't clear what it was during the trial.
Erica, a lot of people are upset over this verdict. Is this case over?
Essentially, the case is over. The Department of Justice said this weekend, they told the Post-Dispatch this weekend, that they had already decided not to do any kind of civil rights investigation into Stockley and how he treated Anthony Lamar Smith. And the judge on Friday, which is when the verdict came down, it was only a bench trial, not a trial by jury. And St. Louis Circuit Judge Timothy Wilson said that he didn't think that the that Stockley's actions at the end of the car chase was, quote, consistent with the conduct of a person intentionally killing another person unlawfully, and therefore that's why he decided to acquit Stockley of first-degree murder charges.
Erica, what was the initial reaction in the city on Friday when the news broke that Stockley was found not guilty?
We had anticipated that Friday was the day it was going to happen, though I think everyone thought it was going to be later. But the moment that the verdict came out, protesters immediately headed downtown, and that started the whole weekend of protests.
The demonstrations have been mostly peaceful, but some have turned violent. Can you tell us what's been happening there?
Sure. So there are sanctioned events every day. There's a core group of organizers who make it very clear to people that want to come out and show their frustration with the verdict that, you know, you can go to these certain places at these certain times, and generally they'll walk around. Sometimes, like on Saturday, they went out to a county mall and, you know, shut it down for a little bit. But generally speaking, the protests are pretty well contained, and they end generally by 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at the latest. And after that, when the sanction events end, the small groups tend to stick around. They've been mostly calmed, except for there's always a turning point. And our reporters, you know, we've asked them, and it's never quite clear what that turning point is. But at the point that things get thrown, and police had said that when protesters start to escalate, that's when they would respond. And when things get thrown, that's when the glass has started to break. That's when things have been you know, flower pots were knocked over in downtown St. Louis, concrete ones, and throwing things through windows last night. So that's generally kind of the turning point, but it's really a wait and see every night.
And Erica, how have police been handling this situation?
They've been mostly measured with the big crowds, especially the organized protests. They seem to have basically be there to make sure that people don't get onto interstates, because there's a lot of on-ramps in the downtown area and over near the Central West End towards I-65 or I-64. So they try to keep them in those directions. But as I said, Interim Police Chief Larry O'Toole said before the verdict came out that they would respond to protesters' escalation, and generally that escalation has been when things get thrown. And so on Friday, pepper spray was used twice before 5:30. They used it again that night. Pepper spray was used last night at the end of the night when they arrested about 80 people total, but, you know, the rest of the evening, that was when the mace came out. So there's been a big show of force, too. Last night especially, you could see just police blockades everywhere in downtown St. Louis, kind of keeping the protesters in one area.
Are you seeing any parallels between what's happening right now in St. Louis and the reaction to the August 2014 killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson?
Certainly. You know, look, it's the parallels here are the race of the victim and the race of the officer. Anthony Lamar Smith was a 24-year-old black man. Stockley is a white man. So I think at the core, protesters are... I think there's a level of frustration in that they you know, seem to think that these things continue, not just in St. Louis and in the St. Louis area, but across the country. So there's anger and frustration. I will say that the difference between this and Ferguson is that we had so much time leading up to the verdict. The trial ended in August, and it didn't get announced until Friday. So it felt more like the night of the grand jury decision in the Michael Brown case, in that we all knew that something was coming and protests were going to happen. We just didn't know when.
And finally, Erica, do we have any idea what the upcoming days and weeks will look like? Are we expecting to see these protests carry on throughout the week?
We certainly do. Activists have vowed, you know, days, possibly weeks of protests because of this acquittal. And they're holding it to it. You're going to see demands coming from the protesters. They've already said that they want the Civilian Oversight Board in the city of St. Louis to have subpoena power. That board reviews citizens' complaints for alleged misconduct by St. Louis police officers. And we saw a new tactic this morning. They had a protest at 7 in the morning, and they had protesters form lines, kind of like a marching band would in a parade, and walk down the street sometimes with their arms linked, but they marched in silence. So we know that there's another protest tonight down in the Del Mar Loop, which is a kind of more upscale area of town, too. So we're just anticipating staffing as many protests as we can in the coming days.
Erica Hunzinger is an editor at St. Louis Public Radio. She's been coordinating a team of reporters there covering the events of this weekend and beyond. Erica, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me on.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. During the Vietnam War, the U.S. sprayed more than 20 million gallons of herbicides that were meant to kill crops, forests, and tree cover in Vietnam. One of the most common chemicals came to be known as Agent Orange, and it later caused higher rates of cancer and miscarriages in millions of people, along with devastating environmental damage in Vietnam. It also turns out one of the chemicals in Agent Orange was developed here in Illinois when military scientists used part of a botany dissertation to make this weapon. As Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's new Vietnam War documentary on PBS gets underway, we here at The 21st wanted to take a look at Agent Orange and its roots in Illinois. Leslie Reagan is a professor of history at the U of I. Nathan Tai is a doctoral candidate in the history department at the University of Illinois as well. Leslie and Nathan, welcome to The 21st.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Leslie, we briefly introduced Agent Orange here, but can you remind listeners exactly what it was and why it was used?
Well, the program was called a defoliation program to kill, as you said, forests and that hid the, quote, enemy and the crops that fed them. So it was always intended to starve Vietnamese and kill the forests, and it was always announced that it was safe, was not going to be harmful to humans, although people got rashes that were called chloracne. And there were complaints from the very beginning from Vietnamese about miscarriages and stillbirths with malformed fetuses, which were dismissed as communist propaganda.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, can you just talk a little bit more about that? What did it do to the people in Vietnam, both during the war and after?
Yeah, and I should also say that while the U.S. called it a defoliation program, plenty called it chemical warfare from the very beginning. And there were also complaints from not only people in Vietnam, but an international complaints and from scientists in the U.S. about this program in the 60s and into the 70s. Caused coughs, skin reactions, blisters, respiratory complaints. And then, as I mentioned, the miscarriages, stillbirths. And then later on, it became apparent that people also had children with disabilities and severe birth defects. And then as years passed, Vietnamese and American veterans saw conditions such as cancers and various, now there are other things recognized like Parkinson's and diabetes and things like that.
Yeah, and that was pretty widespread among American veterans as well as the Vietnamese?
Yes. Well, American veterans fought to have this recognized by the government and by the VA and to get restitution damages from the chemical companies.
Nathan, you've looked into the connection between Illinois and Agent Orange, and it turns out one of the chemicals was actually developed here at the U of I, though not originally for war. Can you tell us how that all happened?
So in 1943, there was a botany and biochemical graduate student by the name of Arthur Galston, and he wrote a dissertation called The Physiology of Flowering on Soybeans, which is innocuous. We're a land-grant university. We do agricultural research. And in the course of his research, discovered a chemical, TIBA, which, if put on soybeans, would increase the buds and the flowering and increase yields for farmers. And it actually increased yields 30%. But if put in higher concentrations on the plant, would defoliate the plant. And so he produced this dissertation, changes his research into rubber, and eventually goes to Yale, where he becomes the head of the department there, and doesn't really think anything of it until years later, in the 1950s, he discovers that his dissertation has been picked up by Army scientists at Fort Detrick in the chemical weapons research facility there, and by the Korean War have weaponized it and turned it into what we now know as Agent Orange, although it wasn't used in that conflict, and then eventually, as Leslie has said, was used during Vietnam.
And what did Arthur Galston do when he found out that his dissertation was being used for this purpose?
So he becomes incredibly angered, and he would discuss later in his life that he was always more political than his scientific colleagues. He had his bar mitzvah the exact same year Hitler came to power, so he always felt that he had an awareness about war and a need to kind of fight it, and he did then during the 60s. He wrote letters to LBJ. He was tried to advocate different scientific groups to come down against its use, and actually in 1971 visited Vietnam to see the effects of what his invention, his discovery, had done. And so in the course of that, he comes to realize that scientists really need to know what their research is being used for. And he advocated for scientists to follow all of their discoveries to their logical conclusion, where even if they've abandoned it or have gone on to new things, they need to follow to see what people are doing, and that scientists then need to organize and really fight the ill use of their research. I mean, this is a research on soybeans. This is not a weapons program. He never thought that this is what it would be used for. And so until the end of his life, he passed away in 2008. He was a strong advocate against the use of these chemicals and the use of science in this way.
Leslie, when and how did Americans begin to become aware of Agent Orange and its effects?
Well, there were certainly the soldiers in Vietnam at the time. They also had suffered the blisters and skin things, and some of them were very wary having been exposed, having been sprayed themselves, having walked through dead forests and having seen the results of the spraying. And of course, they were drinking water and eating food that had been sprayed, and were like, I'm not going to have children ever, because this is what they weren't sure what the results were. Then as it's in the mid-70s that people are submitting things to the VA and talking about miscarriages and infertility and children with birth defects and trying to submit forms for compensation for disabilities, and they're all being rejected. So you have people individually doing that, and then one young veteran who's about 27 gets a diagnosis of stomach cancer, and he's a very healthy, carefully, you know, eats very carefully guy, and says, what is this related to? And figures out it must be Agent Orange, and he broadcasts this and gets a lot of coverage. His name is Paul Reuterschan. So that goes into the public sphere. He gets thousands of veterans making phone calls to him and initiates a lawsuit against the chemical companies. Ultimately, that is 15,000 veterans as part of the class action lawsuit. And the other part is with this VA officer who is a Navy veteran, a woman, who gathers information and tries to help the veterans. And eventually there's a Chicago TV show, and they also publicize this. So there's a lot of individuals with suspicions, and the VA just refuses to believe this. And a very active veterans movement demanding assistance. And it's not until Congress takes it up and forces the VA to respond in 1990 that they get any assistance from the VA.
Leslie, Nathan, we need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation about Agent Orange and its roots here in Illinois. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today.
The 21st is made possible by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Propositions on Revolution, Slogans for a Future, part of the campus-wide commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. We've been talking about Agent Orange, the herbicide that was used for chemical warfare during the Vietnam War. I'm here with Leslie Reagan and Nathan Tai. And Leslie, we were just talking about how veterans came back from the war and noticed that they were suffering from higher rates of cancer, and they eventually sued the Veterans Affairs Department. How did the VA initially respond to this?
Well, they didn't initially sue the VA. They sued the U.S. government, which doesn't go anywhere. The U.S. government doesn't allow itself to be sued. And they sued the chemical companies and eventually were forced into a deal where there was a small amount of money that ended up being very little per veteran. But they kept agitating and got Congress to pass a law requiring the Veterans Administration to recognize an association between Agent Orange and various illnesses and conditions. Now, none of those ultimately recognized anything between the exposure of a veteran and reproductive effects or their children at all, which was one of the major things pushing forward the movement trying to get a response. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, President Clinton did get something passed for spina bifida for female veterans if they were the mothers, but that was all. So for one of the primary concerns, there's never been any recognition at all.
And you know, you've talked about, Leslie, the huge differences between the way Agent Orange is portrayed here in the U.S. and the way it's portrayed in Vietnam. What are the differences?
Well, in the U.S., we don't see any. I was saying at the National Museums at the Smithsonian, which has a really excellent exhibit actually on the Vietnam War. There is nothing at all about Agent Orange. So it's very interesting that we have a lot of media coverage. We have had a lot of stories in newspapers. Veterans actually have their own events around Agent Orange with a quilt of tears. In Vietnam, this is covered quite a bit in the museums, and it's part of the history of the American War, as this war is called, in Vietnam, and the ongoing presence of that war. It's never really ended. It continues in the bodies of Vietnamese, in the land, in the water. And there are many, many photographs of disabled children and adults, of people who've had cancer. And so at the same time that a campaign was developing among veterans in the U.S., there were comparable campaigns of veterans in Korea and Australia, and also a campaign to try to get attention for Vietnamese veterans around Agent Orange. And now there's been a campaign since the 90s that's international to try to get the U.S. to be responsible to provide restitution for all of the people in Vietnam who've been affected by Agent Orange, and also to apologize.
Mm. As we wrap up this conversation, I'll start the same question to both of you, but Leslie, I'll start with you. As we're revisiting the Vietnam War right now with the Ken Burns and Lynn Novick documentary, what do you think more Americans should know about Agent Orange?
Well, I guess one is that wars don't end, and they can have these bodily legacies and environmental legacies that are unanticipated. And we need to think about and deal with those before we jump into and continue wars. And the other is, as we reconstructed Europe following World War II, this has been a convention, and we actually made promises. President Nixon made promises to Vietnam to provide for the reconstruction, and instead we had we cut off all diplomatic relations and required other countries to do the same with Vietnam, and destroyed the economy. So I do think that the demands for some kind of financial assistance are quite reasonable from Vietnam, and that more awareness of Vietnam and what happened to it, rather than seeing the U.S. solely as a victim of its own war, is essential.
And Nathan, how about you? What should more people know about Agent Orange?
I think that they should realize that it's something that just didn't happen over there, that particularly in this community, it's developed here, it's developed for agricultural research, and that it happened in an innocuous way. It's soybean research. So really, it's also a call to scientists to consider the ethics of your research, no matter what it is, what is the outcome, who could use it, where will it go in the future, and just to know that these things can spiral out of control very quickly. And so just to acknowledge that it happens here and that it affects all of us.
Leslie Reagan, professor of history at the University of Illinois, Nathan Tai, doctoral candidate at the U of I. Thank you so much for joining us here on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for the 21st. I'm Brian Moline in for Nyla Boodoo today. After its two-year budget stalemate, Illinois' public universities and community colleges are seeing declines in enrollment on the order of 60,000 fewer students across the state. Fewer students on campus has also translated into thousands of fewer jobs in higher education. On top of all that, the annual college rankings from U.S. News & World Report came out last week, and many Illinois universities saw a drop in the rankings. Should we be concerned about that? In a few minutes, we'll speak with a reporter from Politico who will help us pull back the curtain on college rankings, where they come from, and whether we should take them seriously. But first, joining us on the line to discuss what it will take for higher education in Illinois to recover from the damage that has been done is Bob Bruno. He's a professor and director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois. Bob, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks so much. It's great being here.
Can you tell us first, Bob, which public universities took the hardest hit from the budget impasse?
Well, universities like Northeastern, Chicago State, Governor State, Southern Illinois University, Northern Illinois, all of the public universities saw a negative impact. Certainly the community colleges in addition, my own university did better than others, but over a longer viewing period also has seen a loss of students and a loss of staff and faculty. So it was pretty broad-based, quite frankly, the impact.
Can you tell us, Bob, the schools that had the hardest hit here, what did they have in common?
Well, you know, what they had in common to a great extent is that they are serving a more working class, a lower income population, higher proportion of people of color, a greater dependence on MAP grants, on support, necessary support coming from the state of Illinois as a important stream of revenue so that they can keep tuition affordable for a population that quite frankly has fewer family resources. So these students from these communities find themselves really needing the kind of support that the state of Illinois has historically given to its university systems. And they don't have quite the same endowments, or they don't have the means to raise tuition to support their institutions to the degree that, for example, the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign is able to do.
Yeah, and Bob, you just mentioned the U of I. Some universities were relatively unscathed. The University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and at Chicago have seen increases in their overall enrollment. And I should add, for full disclosure, that Illinois Public Media is affiliated with the University of Illinois. But for those universities that are seeing enrollment declines, how much of it can be attributed specifically to the budget impasse?
So, you know, it's very difficult, of course, to prove causation in every one of these cases. What I think you can look at, however, though, is that you see during this budget impasse a real acceleration in the drop-off in the student population, in some case by double digits. Now that reduction in student enrollment actually precedes the budget impasse. But you can, however, connect it. Go back, maybe go back a decade, and you can connect it to significant drops in the appropriation that was coming from the state of Illinois to higher education. So that, for example, over the, from 2005 to 2015, roughly, you see a drop of about 54% from the state of Illinois to its public universities. And during that time frame, you also see reasonably well correlated a drop-off in the number of students who are intending universities in state. It's strongly suggestive that the support, or the lack of support, or the reduced support that's coming from Springfield is having an impact on the academic choices that families of high school seniors are making. And then in the last 2 years, when we're really into this budget morass, you see a ramping up, an acceleration. And again, correlated to that is you see an increase in tuition rates, where tuition rates go up 50, 45, 59, 60%. And at the same time, universities in Iowa, for example, or in Missouri, frankly, are not showing the same increase in tuition costs, and we begin to see a net outflow of students who find it more affordable to get a really good university education in a neighboring state than they can get here in Illinois, and that's a dramatic historical shift.
Finally, Bob, if we can keep this to about a minute or so, what do you think needs to happen to rebuild higher education here in Illinois?
Well, first of all, the state has to see the university as this powerful economic engine in its future, in its people, and it has to increase its contribution and stop the reduction from what was at 1.34-35% to something in the single digits. And maybe a good step forward would be to consider a multiple-year appropriation. So instead of a one-year appropriation, perhaps a two, a three, four, maybe even a five-year appropriation that will signal to parents, to students, both here in Illinois and across the Midwest and the country, that you have this stable investment being made in the university. So I think looking at the annual appropriation and considering something multiple year out would be certainly one small positive step that would be worth looking at.
Bob Bruno, professor and director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois. Thanks so much for joining us today, Bob.
Thanks. Great to be on.
In addition to declines in enrollment, several public universities saw a drop in the popular college rankings this year from U.S. News and World Report. This sparked news coverage last week from media outlets in Illinois about yet another way in which the state's two-year budget stalemate has harmed higher education in the state. Let's take some time now to step back and understand, how are these college rankings determined, and should we pay as much attention to them as we do? To help us understand this more, I'm joined on the line by Benjamin Wormant. He's an education reporter for Politico Pro. Benjamin, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
It seems like most everyone has heard of U.S. News and World Report's college rankings, but not everyone may understand how they come up with these rankings. Can you help us pull back the curtain a little bit?
Sure. U.S. News has a formula that they use to put these rankings together. They look at a variety of factors, from graduation and retention rates to student selectivity, faculty resources, alumni giving, and then they actually have another factor that measures undergraduate academic reputation, which is based on like a peer survey. So there's a number of things that go into these rankings, but what we found was that basically the key to the bulk of the rankings is money. So it actually makes sense that if your state is cutting funding and your schools have less to spend, that they would be dropping in the rankings.
And looking at the rankings that came out last week and zeroing in here on schools in Illinois, you'll see that several public universities took a hit. For example, the University of Illinois dropped to 52nd from a tie for 44th. Meanwhile, private universities seem to have not been affected. The University of Chicago stayed tied with Yale for third, and Northwestern moved up a notch to 11th. To your mind, is this evidence that public universities in Illinois have gotten worse over the past year?
No, like I said, I mean, it's hard to know for sure, but the U.S. News rankings really do factor, take so much wealth into account in these formula that they have. For instance, there was a 2014 report that found that if a major university in the mid-30s wanted to jump into the top 20, it would have to increase its spending by about $112 million per year. And that's because the criteria that they look at, things like faculty spending, they reward schools for small class sizes, for the amount of money that they can bring in from alumni. It's really, money is the key to these rankings.
You wrote the article for Politico about these rankings, and we'll tweet it out for those who follow us at 21stshow.com. And you make the case that the rankings themselves promote economic inequality. In about 45 seconds or so, can you tell us how you arrived at that conclusion?
Sure. Well, just so many of these factors incentivize schools to favor wealthier students, from giving credit for schools that have students that do better on standardized tests, which correlate strongly to family income, to having a lower acceptance rate, which a lot of colleges can game by leaning on early admissions, early decision admissions, which is kind of a complicated process, but it's been shown to hurt lower income applicants. And again, rewarding things like spending that can drive up tuition costs and leave low-income students out.
And we'll expand on this in just a moment, but we need to take a quick break. Benjamin Wormant, an education reporter for Politico Pro, discussing the U.S. News & World Report college rankings. We'll have more of this conversation coming up on the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. We're pulling back the curtain a bit on college rankings from U.S. News and World Report, and we're talking about this with Benjamin Warmond, an education reporter for Politico Pro. Benjamin, you talk about in your article how the rankings can create incentives for colleges to spend money and effort on things that may help them rise in the rankings, but may contribute to economic inequality. Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah, so the article looked at two schools, actually, to kind of illustrate this point. One is Georgia State University, a state school in Georgia that has done a lot to diversify economically. It's nearly doubled its number of students on Pell Grants, which are grants for low-income students. They've, at the same time, pushed up their graduation rate by about 22%, and in the process, they've made what they describe as a moral decision to care less, I guess, about student selectivity. They say if you have a B average, they'll take you, and their average SAT score has dropped by about 33 points. So as they've been serving this more diverse student body in a way that seems to be pretty successful with their rising graduation rate, they actually dropped quite a bit in the rankings over the last 8 to 10 years or so. At the same time, we looked at another school, Southern Methodist University, a private school in Texas, that launched this billion-dollar fundraising campaign and basically credited that to a six-spot jump in the rankings. And the reason that they were able to rise that way is because of some of these factors that I talked about. Their SAT score went up. Again, these tests like SAT tend to favor students from families that make more money. They were able to spend more on faculty, pay them more, have smaller class sizes. Basically, everything that U.S. News rankings rewards, they were able to use this money on. To be fair, the latest rankings, Georgia State did go up some and SMU actually dropped a little bit, but overall, over the roughly a decade or so, we looked at those, the overall trend.
And finally, Benjamin, you did speak with someone from U.S. News who defended the rankings. What was their argument?
Sure. Well, I mean, they point out that they're not setting admission standards at schools, and that their main goal is to provide information for prospective students and their parents, and they say that they're measuring academic quality, and they stand by their formula for measuring that. They argued that if a school is doing what U.S. News will reward and spending more on faculty, recruiting better students, having smaller class sizes, all of that, better graduation rates, then they argue they are a better school in the end.
Benjamin Warmond is an education reporter for Politico Pro, and again, we'll link out his article on this topic from our Twitter account at 21stshow.com. Benjamin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Last Friday, Attorney General Lisa Madigan announced that she will not be running for re-election. That stunned most political observers in Illinois, but she's not the only one. More than two dozen state lawmakers are also not running again. Every Monday, we bring you the latest in Illinois politics, and as always, we've got two political reporters on the line to help us understand what's behind the headlines, including this sudden wave of elected officials deciding to hang it up. Tony Arnold with WBEZ and Chris Kergard with the Peoria Journal-Star. Gentlemen, welcome back to the 21st.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Of course, the big news came from Attorney General Lisa Madigan announcing that she's not running for re-election in 2018. Chris, how big of a surprise was this to you?
I frankly was shocked by it simply because it was
so well kept of a secret up until the announcement and so unexpected. She's become a fixture in Illinois politics and government, second only to Jesse White as far as longest serving office holders we have right now in state executive positions. So it was quite a surprise. But having interviewed the Attorney General a number of times over the years, her focus has been less on the collection of and exercise of power than it's been of trying to accomplish things and trying to do what she feels are good things. So I guess it does not surprise me that much in that if she feels she can do that elsewhere outside of government and get a new challenge, then it seems in fitting with her character to want to do something new and to reboot occasionally.
And Tony, what do you think this means in terms of, you know, who could be our next attorney general? Of course, Erica Harold is the Republican who's announced that she's running to originally challenge Attorney General Madigan. Are now there any Democrats in particular who might run for this office?
Well, that side of things is very wide open at this point because it was such a surprise. No Democrat was going to run against Lisa Madigan in the primary, so the fact that that is a open position now, an open seat, makes it a wide open on the Democratic side of things, and I'm sure within half an hour, an hour of Lisa Madigan announcing she's not going to run for the seat. State Senator Kwame Raoul, who's a Hyde Park, Chicago state senator, was out in front of the Thompson Center doing TV interviews saying, well, I'm interested in it. Not officially running, but, you know, he's someone that's been talked about running for that position for a long time. And again, he wasn't going to challenge Lisa Madigan in the primary. So since the initial, you know, announcement, there's been, I can't even keep up with how many different people have said they are interested in it. I think there's got to be at least half a dozen at this point, just on the Democratic side. And then on the Republican side, you're right. Erica Harold, who ran for Congress and lost in the Republican primary a couple of years ago there against Rodney Davis, announced that she would run against Lisa Madigan, and it didn't look like there were going to be any other Republicans running. I think with the prospects of not facing a Madigan who always, you know, has done very well traditionally in her four campaigns statewide, kept most Republicans out of the race from wanting to run against her. And now it looks, you know, it's possible that there could be a few other Republicans taking a second look at this, wondering if they want to run against Erica Harold for the Republican nomination.
You know, Chris, do you have any sense of why Lisa Madigan is not running again? What has she said so far about this?
Well, essentially, she said in her public announcement that she was looking for new challenges and different opportunities. She did not rule out additional runs for office down the line, nor did she rule anything else in. There's been a great deal of speculation as to what else she might be interested in down the line, whether that's a potential run for governor in 4 years if Bruce Rauner is reelected, or potentially 8 years if a Democrat wins the seat next year. Everybody should bear in mind that Lisa Madigan is relatively young in political terms, and we don't necessarily think about that because she's been such a fixture over the last 16 years in Illinois government. You know, you tend to think of her as having been around for quite some time, but in her early 50s, she still has 20 plus years of political viability as a candidate left to her. So she could sit things out and go into private practice as an attorney or work for not-for-profits, pick particular issues to focus on for the next 2, 4, 6, 8 years before mounting a political comeback. There's also been speculation about, you know, potential appointments to a Senate seat if Dick Durbin decides not to run again or to resign early. There's been a lot of speculation over the years or suggestion that, boy, she'd make an interesting Illinois Supreme Court justice. A couple of times when there have been U.S. Supreme Court vacancies, she's even made it onto a what-if list of potential appointees. All of those are valid options for her, but I think at this point it's really too early to judge
what her next step is going to be, other than I think she's been very good at seizing opportunities when they've come around.
And Tony, of course, Attorney General Madigan is not the only one who's decided to call it quits. As of this morning, more than two dozen legislators have said that they're not running for re-election. That's 15% of the state House. And the latest of note is Representative Barbara Flynn Curry, who's been the House Majority Leader for the last 20 years. Can you give us an idea, Tony, of what's driving all these announcements?
Yeah, it's when you're dealing with that many people not running for re-election, it's a little different depending on who you go. But there is a common theme among a lot of them. I actually have like a list that I have on my desktop that I keep reopening every day and putting a new name on it of who's not running for re-election. And as I'm looking at it right now, there's some people who just have said they don't want to run again. Some people who have said they don't like the tone that things have taken in Springfield, the change in tone. Barbara Flynn Curry, who you mentioned, again, a Chicago Democrat, said that I heard her in some of her interviews, I can't even make a plan to see my family, my grandkids, because Springfield's so crazy and I can't. You keep going back for special sessions because of the impasse, and for either whether it was state budget impasse or whether it was school funding impasse. And then some people, as common, you know, which is kind of not common, are just, you know, running for higher office, like a Daniel Biss or Scott Drury. And so they'll be leaving the legislature and leaving open seats behind to make that run. But yeah, this goes back to, you know, beginning of July with the state budget impasse, when the Republican Senate leader, Christine Redonio, from Chicago's western suburbs, announced she abruptly quit, ending I believe it was more than two decades of service in Springfield, always seen as kind of a moderate Republican, someone who could get a deal done, and resigned her seat very abruptly, right as the talks over a state budget were really gaining a lot of traction. So it's kind of the whole gamut. It's Chicago Democrats, it's downstate Republicans, a lot of different people who are just kind of getting really fed up with just how nasty things have gotten at the state house.
Sure. Chris, you know, of all these names of people who are calling it quits, you know, we mentioned Christine Redonio, we mentioned Barbara Flynn Curry. Any other names that really stand out to you on that list so far?
Several of them as longtime legislators who are kind of go-to people when you want to get something done. Elaine Nekritz in the House Democrats, who really has matured into a legislator who's a good deal maker and brings people along. She worked on the pension reform bill several years ago that ultimately was declared unconstitutional, but managed to get folks on board with that. Bob Pritchard and Patty Bellock, Mike Fortner on the House Republican side, as again, folks who have been kind of quiet leaders who, I don't want to suggest that, you know, any of them on the left or the right have been moderate, that being such an awful political term for some people nowadays, but have been people who can work productively across the aisle and build consensus on legislation. What's interesting to note, though, is we're seeing this, we're making note of it now because of a lot of the complaints that lawmakers have had about the last two and a half years in Springfield and the poisonous atmosphere. But if you look at the tenure for many legislators, it is not often a lengthy tenure. Fully more than half of the state house and a significant portion, well, more than a third of the state senate, have only been in office for 10 years or less. So there does tend to be a lot of legislative turnover. We're simply seeing more of it this year because of that pent-up frustration, and we're seeing some of those bigger names, a Nekritz or a Bellock or a Curry or a Redonio, who are stepping down after having been there a little while longer than many of their colleagues.
I just piggyback on that, and I'm looking at this list, and it is a lot of people who are very well-established in Springfield who have been there just anecdotally here, looking at this list more than 10 years, there's only a couple names who are pretty young people who aren't going to be running for re-election, or young or haven't been in the state house very long. Sarah Wojcicki Jimenez, who represents Springfield in the House. Steve Anderson, another Republican who represents the western suburbs of Chicago in the House, hasn't been there that long. Laura Fine from Evanston wants to run for the state senate rather than the House. So it's young people in addition to some of the more established folks there.
Chris Kergard from the Peoria Journal Star, Tony Arnold from WBEZ Public Radio in Chicago. Thanks both for joining us today.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
And we didn't have time to even mention Governor Rauner's trip to Asia. We'll be talking about that on the show tomorrow, as Governor Rauner will join us on the 21st. That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for the 21st. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecelio, Bob Holly, and Sean Newman. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.